So, good evening. Hello. The last time I was at a partner dinner, I was sitting on the other end of the tables. I think it was a little more comfortable. So, for the 99% of the people that don't know me, my name is David Makagon. I'm on Twitter as dmakagon. That's D-M-A-K-O-G-O-N. In case you get a lot of annoying Windows Azure tweets, that's me. I'm behind them. So, I joined in October, joined Microsoft. And just before joining, I was given this title of Windows Azure MVP on October 1st. I have the dubious honor of being the world's first former Windows Azure MVP, because 24 days later, I had to give it up to come work for Microsoft. I also spent some time on loan to Microsoft for 6 months as a virtual employee, a technology specialist, helping out the sales team with Windows Azure. So I've been working with it since about beginning of 2009. Sorry, I need to address the people over there too. Hi there. Just by a show of hands, before we get into tonight's content, who has heard of Windows Azure? We'll start with the simple one. Every hand but like one. Excellent. Oh, every hand. Okay. Who has actually installed the Windows Azure tools? Okay, about three or four hands. And of those three or four hands, who's actually gone through some exercises and built an app? Okay, so two or three hands. And then of those people that built an app, who actually pushed it up to Windows Azure and then like, told their friends? Okay, so I got an almost. Okay, so I'm going to, knowing that, I'm going to shift things around a little bit. And I want to make sure that we're all on the same page when it comes to Windows Azure. But nearly everybody put their hands up when they said they knew of it. Does that mean you know what it is, and you like if you got stuck in an elevator with somebody and had 30 seconds to explain it, you could do that? Okay. Just does anyone want to go in the elevator and explain it? So let's start off and just make sure we're all on the same page. So I'm going to use this deck, and we're going to bounce around a little bit. I just want to make sure we're all on the same page, and we know what Windows Azure is, and maybe a little bit about what it isn't, and then what you can do with it today. As it happens, every single time I do a talk, there's always something that gets announced the day I'm doing a talk. And this, of course, happened today as well, so I'll talk about what was announced today. Although I can't show it, I don't have access to it yet, but we'll talk about it. So one of the things, now my job is to work with ISVs, and I've worked with a couple of public sector ISVs, I've worked with private sector. I mean, it doesn't matter who I work with. What I have up on the screen are some very, very common thoughts and discussions that we have with ISVs. Extending an existing solution, right? They want to move to the cloud, so they want to kind of grow their application out, right? This whole idea of pay-as-you-go versus sinking a ton of money in capital expenditures, like buying a server room full of machinery. Why not just pay? If I need it today, I pay for it today. Need it tomorrow, I pay for it tomorrow. So that comes up a lot. Like, how can I optimize and maximize the cash flow? How can I get to market quicker? And just, I got to ask this question. Anybody work with like databases, SQL Server? Has anybody actually asked for a SQL Server? And can you describe to me in days, weeks, or months how long it takes to get the order in, the box shipped, the software installed, and all that stuff? I mean, is it, what, a day?
Yeah, day and a half.
Okay, so translate into real-world terms, it's?
Yeah, for us, easily a month.
A month, okay. So how can we speed that up? Because maybe that's blocking your time to market. Focus on core IP. This comes up more and more. And this basically, it's very simply put, I just want to build my app. I don't want to build a data center. I don't want to maintain network switches. I just want to focus on what I do best, building my applications. I want to be able to expand into new market segments. Maybe that means geographic markets. So how could I expand that way? Maybe it means I want different outlets for my business data. And of course, you know, that also includes global markets. We'll talk about that a little bit. So I just want to make sure I kind of gave you a reference frame of mind for what I deal with, the kind of questions I get asked, how do I do that? So the other piece, I just want to make sure we're all on the same page. This is a very common slide, but I tend to not dwell on it too much. I just want to make sure we're all on the same page with definition, that on one far end of the spectrum is the world of the on-premise data center, full server, you build it yourself, you maintain everything, and one day you actually build your software, but you're dealing with things all the way from the networking stack on up and the cables going into the buildings and contracting with the utility companies, and we all love doing that, don't we? On the other far end of the spectrum is your Hotmail and Gmail and Exchange Online. It's called software as a service. It's, you don't even get to touch the infrastructure. You have nothing to install. You just go to a web page, you log on, and you're off and running. And then in the middle, we have what we call infrastructure as a service, which it's a little bit of a blurred line, but it usually means that all this underlying networking and storage and physical stuff is taken care of for you, and then you maintain from the OS on upward. So if you think about Amazon's service, that's considered infrastructure as a service. You're typically pushing a virtual machine up into their infrastructure. They're providing all the virtualization, but you still have that VM that you're building and maintaining. And then there's this notion of platform as a service. When we talk about Windows Azure as platform as a service, people say, well, what's the difference between infrastructure and platform? Well, in the platform world, the OS is abstracted from you. You don't really have to worry about that anymore. You don't have to worry about building the OS and putting up the patches and licensing and all that stuff. And typically, you don't worry about middleware and runtime. So all the things that get installed into Windows Server and a lot of infrastructure around messaging and storage, we don't have to worry about that. Database, we don't have to worry about that. You're really worrying about your applications and data. Now, there's a slight disclaimer. If you're installing some third-party tools, maybe you do have to worry about some runtime. If you're pushing up Postgres, you know, SQL Server or MongoDB or some other type of server like Tomcat, there's a little bit of runtime that you have to manage, but that's easily uploadable. So does that all make sense? That's kind of the story of the on-premise to software as a service world. Great. So Windows Azure, I guess everybody, they say they know of it. I just want to make sure we're fully understanding. We have three core areas. And what's really important to understand is you can consume exactly what you want. You don't buy into the entire platform. You buy into the pieces that you need. So on the far left, we see Windows Azure, which is our compute. And just to dispel the myth about compute, it really is just Windows Server 2008 SP2 or Windows Server 2008 R2. These are not mysterious magic boxes. And along with compute, we have some massively scalable storage. We have Windows Azure tables, which are non-relational tables, schemaless. And you can go up to 100 terabytes per account. We have blob storage, so if you think about files and streams, videos, things like that, you could put in blob storage. And we have queues. These are durable message queues. In the middle slot, we have SQL Azure, which is a large subset of SQL Server. And what's really cool about SQL Azure, we just talked about SQL Server being a month for deployment. You could deploy a server in about 1 or 2 seconds and deploy a database on that server in another 1 or 2 seconds. Now, there are some limitations, and we can discuss those. If you guys are all SQL people, we could talk about some differences tonight. I just want to say you can subscribe into that. And then the third piece that we talk about is App Fabric. This slide shows connectivity and access control. So access control is who gets to use my stuff, and maybe you want to outsource it. So you want somebody to log in with their Windows Live ID instead of you maintaining username and password. That's kind of cool to do that. And then there's connectivity. We have lots of connectivity. We have the service bus, so you connect 2 points and not worry about things like firewalls. Although, let me give you your first tip of the day. If you're going to use the service bus and you're putting it inside your data center, it's a really good idea to tip off the IT guys, even though you can get away with it. If they find out, I don't know, maybe they won't buy you lunch anymore. We have what's called Azure Connect, which is our software VPN. So instead of just having web services over a service bus, you could actually have access to an entire machine, possibly an Active Directory server, and connect that to the rest of your Windows Azure instances. And then something new came out today, and we'll talk about that, and that is the Windows Azure App Fabric applications. So now, instead of you building these things piecemeal, you could build a cohesive single entity called your application, and it could have your WCF services and your database and your compute all in a nice little bundle. And it can support multi-tenancy and scalability, where you don't have to worry about individual servers. Any questions on this? Am I just rehashing everything you know, or like, we're good? This is good. Good to know. Okay. So, compute. Who knows about Windows Azure Compute? Everybody? Or is this like kind of a brand new concept? All right. Compute is a fancy name for virtual machines running in the cloud. So there we go. I just defined compute. Anyone know what these things are? Web role, worker role, VM role? Are these common terms? Or does somebody not know what they are? Anyone not know what they are? Excellent. Okay. So for the people that do know what they are, I'm going to give you a little tidbit just so you could walk away and say, I learned something. Web roles are your Windows server with IIS, and it's a perfect place to host a website or web services. It is basically Windows Server 2008 running IIS, just like any other Windows Server 2008 running IIS. A worker role is basically Windows Server 2008, except you typically don't put websites on a worker role. You might put more of a background process or something that runs on a timer, maybe reads from a queue. Maybe you run your own web server like Tomcat or Jetty, where you're listening in on port 80. So you can host that in a worker role. And a VM role is a little bit more infrastructure-ish. You can build your own Windows Server 2008 image with Hyper-V, spend all the time building up a virtual machine just the way you like it, and then install some Windows Azure extensions and push it up to the cloud. And I'm going to tell you, you should not use VMroll, except for three reasons I will give you tonight. For the people that did know what WebRoll and WorkerRoll were, did you know that they are nearly completely equivalent? Did you also know that you could launch IIS inside your worker role? Okay, just wanted to make sure. Somebody say, no, I didn't know that. I just learned that. It's actually installed on the worker role. They are functionally equivalent. Web and worker role are functionally equivalent. The main difference is the templating you get inside Visual Studio, because Visual Studio makes it really easy to add websites in a web role, and you're pretty much on your own in a worker role. So it's not like you would choose a worker role to run IIS. I'm just trying to point out that they really are the same. The VM role we'll get into in a little bit. I want to have a little discussion around that, of when you would and wouldn't use it. But let me just, does anyone care about pricing? You know, okay. So what I'm showing you on the screen is list price. There are many, many different pricing scenarios. So it doesn't mean everybody pays 12 cents an hour per CPU core. There are accelerator packs where if you commit for 6 months, you can get some significant discounts. Actually, I think some are expiring June 30th. I could show you some of these plans. But, I mean, there's discounts pretty deep. And then if you're with an organization that has an enterprise agreement, these discounts run pretty deep. But this is sort of list price just for discussion purposes. The way that the compute stuff works is it starts off, forget extra small for a moment, per core you pay 12 cents an hour. So you're averaging about $85 a month per virtual machine instance, assuming it's a small machine, and it scales. We start off small with almost 2 gigs of RAM, 1/4 terabyte of local scratch storage. You could do whatever you want with it. And you have one processor. And the other thing is you have about 100 megabits of network bandwidth. Now, that scales linearly all the way up to the high end, where you have 8 cores, nearly about 14, 15 gigs of RAM, and 800 megabits on your network interface. So the advice I'll give you as you think about your app, and we'll just build a sample app and play, but the one thing to think about, and this is a totally backward way to think when you own the machines, when you call up Dell or HP or somebody and you order these servers, the first thing you think about is, well, I'm going to get myself a quad-core box. Only $100 more, $200 more, I'll get an 8-core. I'll just slip in more RAM. I mean, you just keep building these machines up because you only get one chance to buy the box, right? Somebody gives you the budget line, and you're just going to buy the biggest iron you can get. And a lot of times, that iron sits idle. If you have any type of application that follows work patterns on time of day, right? 9 to 5 or 8 to 5 workflow. You get the big surge in the morning as people hit that first cup of coffee and now they're visiting your site all hyped up on caffeine. And by the end of the day, they're kind of worn out and they go home and now your site's not being used as much. So your site is getting slammed for like 8 hours, a lot of utilization. And all 8 cores are going and you're feeling great about your investment. And then at night, you know, 3 in the morning, of course, anyone could hit the site and get instantaneous response because they're like the only one on this huge box that you bought. So the idea is when you're in the cloud, go the opposite. Think about the smallest footprint you could run your application in. Could your application actually run in just under 2 gigs of RAM? Could it run with just 1 processor and just 100 megabits of network? And before you say no, because we always run with 4 cores, we always run with 1 gigabit. Before you say no, think about it. If just 1 user is visiting, will your app actually load and run? Now, some apps won't. There are apps that need 8 gigs and 10 gigs of RAM. I mean, let's be realistic. There are some big applications. But if you don't have one of those and you have one of the smaller applications and it will run with just 1 or 2 users, everybody's happy, maybe 50 users simultaneously. I mean, you'd have to do some load testing. But realistically, could you get away with 1? You know, 1 core, the smallest box. And if that's the answer, if it's yes, then that should serve as the basis for your application, because with a parameter change, you can scale out to 2 boxes, to 3 boxes, to 10 boxes. And so you can handle the load by distributing across a whole bunch of boxes. Now, in a data center where you're paying for these boxes and you have a capital expense and you're writing the check, it becomes a little painful to describe that to somebody. Like, I need to buy 15 boxes, and I'm only going to have my app running on 1 box at night, and I'm going to scale it out to like 15 boxes during the day. And they'll think you're crazy because you just sunk like a fortune into these boxes. But in the cloud, 1 box, I mean, 12 cents an hour. So what is that, $85 divided by 30? What does that come out to a day? $3 a day? Well, what's your incremental cost if you need to add a second box for 8 hours? I mean, it's certainly not as much. I mean, you're not doubling your cost. You probably add 3 or 4 or 5 just for that surge period and then bring it back down. That's a big advantage of going to the cloud, and you want to start thinking in those terms. You don't want to necessarily scale up, because even during the high periods, you're really using all that box. And then when you scale down, you're left with this 8-core thing. You can't dynamically say, I want to go from 8 cores to 4 to 2. You pick your core size and you pretty much stick with it. So you want that smallest footprint when you're sleeping, so you're not burning money in your sleep. Although you could dream of burning money in your sleep, you don't really want to. There is this thing called an extra small instance. It's shared CPU, 5 megabits on the network card. It's really low end, great for your informational sites that don't get hit much, great for background processes where you're calling maybe a stored procedure once an hour and not doing much in way of computation. And it could really save a lot by putting some stuff in there. Any questions on pricing? This is kind of core compute pricing. Yeah?
I see per service hour, most businesses don't run 24 hours a day. Are there ever contracts where they can get so many hours per day over a length of time?
So the question was about service hours, and some businesses don't run 24/7. Can you get some type of deal? Here's the way it works, and maybe this is a little bit of a confusion point, but when you deploy your virtual machine, it's live, it's running. Even if it's at 0% utilization, we don't meter your utilization. You could run it at 100%, we don't care. You're paying for the reserved core. It's just like if you rented a hotel room and then you never showed up, you went sightseeing. You know, you're 0% utilization, but you're still paying for it. What you could do is tear down the deployment if you're not using it, but that brings it completely offline. And it's not exactly advisable. Because even if a business closes in the middle of the night, there still might be somebody that wants to visit, wants to go to your homepage and find out information. And you have to think, what's the value, or what's the potential loss if somebody goes to yoursite.com and you're not there because you decided to shut down from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. So
So businesses at peak periods, of course, you would run your 24/7, and that's the whole reason you did it. And so if you wanted to sell it to, say, universities, they could just do it for 9 months and then stop.
Well, the university will still want to have, the question was about universities, so you have the school season, and people are checking their grades, and they're going online or possibly registering for classes. They have a need for 24/7 access, even if the traffic is extremely low. Because if you go to University of Maryland, College Park, well, that's where I went, but if you go to their website and there's no website there because it's summer vacation, or it's Christmas and the school is closed that day, that's kind of awkward. I mean, you would want it running, but what you wouldn't want is 8 instances running that day because you barely have any traffic. You just want the minimum. And then you scale it up during those high seasons. Another good example is Girl Scout cookie sales. Who doesn't love Girl Scout cookies? So Girl Scout cookies, they have 2 seasons a year. I mean, you see the girls show up in front of the grocery stores for like a 6-week period, then they disappear. And then they come back for 6 weeks and they disappear. And then, of course, all the cookies are showing up at the office and we all eat and put on weight. Thin Mints, right? Okay. Girl Scout cookies, twice a year they have this surge. So imagine putting them in the cloud and they scale up to 10 and 12 servers during this high period where everybody's checking their orders and ordering more cookies and their sales reports. And then it goes dark. You still have to have 1 or 2 instances sitting around because there will always be somebody visiting. Thank you for participating in our 2011 spring cookie sales. See you in the fall. I mean, you have to have something. Yeah.
So the scenario that I have heard of that where people do that is for development environments where they will actually deploy that environment, work on it for a while, and when they're done with it, let's say for the next 2 months they might not work on that app again, they'll actually tear down and take offline that development version so that it doesn't. Like, there are some cases where you do that. And I think what you're saying, your point would be in most of these cases is I can buy that small instance and then I can tell you variably how many of those I'd like to have running, and I'd be trying to move back to the 12 cents per hour model at low times to keep my cost.
Exactly. So this was about like a dev environment, in case you couldn't hear it, just repeating the question. If you're a developer, developers get free hours. I mean, we'll talk about that tonight. So let's say that you had a Microsoft Developer Network subscription and you get 1,500 hours a month. The last thing you want to do is be building a 4-instance app and burn all your 1,500 hours in 2 weeks. When you go to sleep at night, you delete your deployment. And then you work locally, and then you bring up your deployment when you need to test again. And so you keep bringing it up and down. You're right. It's a development environment. Yep.
Can you run multiple at the same time? So say I wanted to run extra small in the evening and extra large during the day, and I wanted to cleanly migrate from one to the other, so I'd maybe run 2 extra smalls, and then I'd run, add in an extra large to kind of migrate the load over from one to the other.
The question was, can I change the size of my virtual machines during the day or like different times? The answer is you would have to completely redeploy. That's a facet of your application that you bake in before you deploy. So that's why I was saying you want to pick the smallest you can get away with, and then you kind of sit low with the minimum number. Now, before we get into storage, I want to talk a little bit about SLA, because by way of answering, let me start with an email I got from one of my ISVs a few weeks ago. It turns out we have an SLA, or 99.99 whatever percent uptime. And the way you get that is... SLA, service level agreement. In order to get that uptime guarantee, you have to run 2 or more instances of, let's just use their website, for example. We're in a web role, and you want your website, people show up at your .org or .gov or .com, right? And you always want it to be there. You have to run 2 or more instances. And so I got an email from one of my ISVs that said, "We know about the SLA, but can you waive the clause for me? I just want to run 1 instance because we barely have any traffic. So could you just put a waiver in my contract? I want the SLA with 1. So politely, I informed him, "Well, no, I can't. As much as I'd love to, I like waivers and I like freebies and stuff." The reason is the way we get an SLA, it's not magic. Let's tune our heads and envision the world of the data center and racks of servers. And imagine there's a rack filled with servers. And somewhere in that rack is a server that's hosting 8 cores, and somewhere in that server is your 1-core virtual machine running Windows Server 2008. And the whole world is actually being directed to that server. There's several things that can happen to that server. One is it's sitting in a virtual machine in the server. The server software might get updated, causing a reboot, which means your virtual machine gets rebooted. Maybe your virtual machine itself gets rebooted. We do that about once a month for software updates, OS updates. So now you've been rebooted. Oh, wait, the server crashed, the memory chip fried. All right, we have to quickly move you to another server. That takes, what, 5 or 10 minutes to get you back up and running. Wait, the server didn't crash. The router on the top of the rack caught fire. The entire rack caught fire. The entire container that the rack was in caught fire. Something horrible happened. If you only have one instance, you're going offline at least once a month, and maybe more, especially if you have buggy software and you crash, whatever, who knows. Once you have two or more instances, we then deploy you into what we call fault domains, separate fault domains. One will be in this rack on this side of the data center, and I know I'm going off camera, but one will be way over here in some other rack in another area of the data center. And so even if one of the servers goes down, the other one's still running, and we're quickly spinning up to replace the one that went down. But at least you still have a presence. Maybe it's during peak time, and now you're seeing a little bit of a slowdown to your customers, but you're still online. So that's how we get the SLA. So when I showed you that pricing chart, I want you to think about that as you start to think about what you're building on Windows Azure. You want your customer-facing and really important stuff to have two instances. That should be your baseline bottom of the line system is two instances. Now, for background stuff, remember we talked a little bit about these worker roles. So the worker role, maybe you have hourly tasks that run a database script, or they run every 5 minutes and they read from a queue and look for commands. Maybe it's okay by you if that goes offline for 10 minutes because it's not real time. Imagine a photo uploading site. You upload your photo and it's your vacation photo, and within like 15 or 20 minutes, it has thumbnails and different sizes, and people can purchase your photos. Well, who cares if it takes 15 minutes or 30 minutes? I mean, you put the link on Facebook and you're done with it. Eventually, your photos will show up. So maybe it's okay to run one instance of this guy and two instances of your web role, right? Customer facing, really important. Make sure you have that SLA. Background task, it's okay sometimes to not worry about the SLA. What you're doing, though, I mean, I can't speak for your individual products. You might have to go for that SLA. Does that make sense? All right. I'm not speaking gibberish. This is a kind of a really important thing about the cloud and SLA and envisioning where your servers are, kind of using your imagination to understand why the SLA is like that. It's not like we just want you to have two instances.
What you just described is a little different from what I've understood. It sounds as if when you upload your machine, you are physically now locked to one piece of hardware, which may, as you say, catch fire or whatever. It's not that if I upload again tomorrow, will it go to the same place?
The question was, are you hardware locked? When you upload, do you always go to the same hardware? Absolutely not. You get completely virtualized. You have no idea what hardware you're going to be put on. But while you're up and running, we can't actually move you. I mean, you're live, you're running. If something happens, like the machine has a short or we have to reboot it, you'll be brought up. If it's just a reboot because of a software update, you'll come back in the same place. But if there's a physical hardware failure, you'll come up in a different rack somewhere else. We'll just reallocate you and you'll be up and running. There's no specific tie to hardware. And then if you were to completely delete the entire deployment and then re-push it, you show up somewhere else.
So after a trivial fault, you'll come back in the same place, but anything significant, you will be...
After a trivial fault, meaning like we updated the OS, we put in a patch, which is not really a fault. We're just rebooting you to get the new drivers, or we had to reboot the host that you're sitting on. Right. That typically, you'd come up in the same place, but you never know that. I mean, your IP address is one IP address. Even if you have 10 instances, one IP address. Yeah, sorry.
On the scaling to load question,
mm-hmm.
are is Azure now able to scale dynamically, or is that still when you push your app, when you deploy your app, you have to tell it how many instances you want? Or can you set, depending on my, if my load is X, I want Y number of instances?
The question was, does Windows Azure scale dynamically? The answer is, we do not offer a dynamic scaling solution, but we give you everything that you would need to scale. We have we allow you to expose performance counters and queue lengths and all that stuff. There are third-party vendors that are doing exactly what you're asking about, such as Paraleap. They make a program called Azure Watch, which is monitoring as a service. There's a few others. And they take a look at your diagnostic data that you publish, like the performance counters, and you tell it, I want minimum 2 instances, maximum 8 instances. And I want you to check every minute, and I want you to look at CPU. If it goes over 60% on average, then I want you to bump up by 1. If it goes below 20%, I want you to bump down by 1. They have all these rules built in. So you could do that. And that's pretty inexpensive. And then we have scaling built into System Center, Microsoft Operations Manager. So if I don't know if you have that at your organization. Some companies do. There's a Windows Azure plugin for that. So we talked a lot about compute. Let's talk a little bit about storage. This is not SQL. This is not Oracle. This is not a relational database. We're talking about completely non-relational, just massively scalable storage. We have tables, and a table is sort of like a database table where you can have a name of a table and then rows are your entities. But the difference is you could store anything you want in any row. Now, I'm not advising that, like to have 7 different object types all in one table. Tables are free. You just pay for storage. You might as well create multiple tables. But it's really just a serialized object. It's like a giant string that's sitting in the table. You can put whatever you want. And these tables, like I said, they go up to 100 terabytes. Very, very large. And they all have what's called a REST endpoint, if you're familiar. Anyone understand REST? Which is sort of like a web service call. And you can make these web service calls from not only Windows, you can make it from Android and iOS. If you're building an iPhone app, you can do it from a desktop application. All of the blobs, tables, queues, accessible anywhere. Blobs are for your larger storage units. Like if you are posting images, let's say you have a website full of images, you can actually store your images in blob storage instead of uploading them with your website. Because if you upload them with your website and then you have to change your logo, you have to redeploy your entire website. That's a big deal. It's like pushing out a new version of an app. But if you store all of your graphics in blob storage and you have your image tags that point to blob storage, you just upload a new image and your website just starts showing the new image. It's as easy as that. And then queues. If anybody's ever used Microsoft Message Queue, this is a little bit different. You write to a queue and it's in this gigantic storage system. It's durable, meaning it's not going to crash on you. You can't lose the queue items. It's called guaranteed at least once delivery, meaning if you read something off the queue, you sign a contract at that moment that I will process this queue message within, 30 seconds or an hour. And if I don't finish processing in that time window, I want you to let somebody else read it, even if it's me reading it again. And so if, let's say that you're doing thumbnails of images, just a simple example, and it takes you 31 seconds because somebody uploads one of these massive, gigantic megapixel off a brand new camera kind of image, and you weren't expecting that, and you go, oh, yeah, okay, I read the queue item, I processed the image, I stuck the thumbnail into another blob, and now I go to delete the queue message, and it says, I'm throwing an exception. You don't own this anymore. Somebody else does. You go, oh, I can't believe I did that. Now, it just so happens that another worker role grabbed it at that very moment, and for some reason he had less going on in memory, and he was able to process it within 30 seconds, and he was able to delete. So the real key for working with queues, the magic word of today, is item potency, which means any action done by a queue message has to be repeatable with the same results, no side effects. For instance, generate thumbnail of image X and put it in blob Y. You could do that 1,000 times. All it's costing you is time and CPU. But transactions such as sell 100 shares of MSFT, is probably not a good thing to put in a queue, because you probably only really want to execute that once and not over and over again. And that last item, Azure drives, imagine this. You can have like a 1 terabyte blob and mount an NTFS volume in it and put a whole file system in it. So maybe you have all program files that you use, utilities that you use. Maybe you have a legacy application that only understands writing to physical drives with a drive letter. Well, you can mount a gigantic drive inside a blob, and now you have what's called durable storage. And maybe now's the time for me to talk about durable storage, because I realized I haven't brought that up. So on your local VM, I mentioned catching fire before, like your machine could blow up. Well, there's some disk inside the VM, and that disk could die. It's non-durable scratch disk. You know, use it at your peril. Put temp files on it. If you're processing a thumbnail image, really great place to do it. You're processing a PDF report for somebody, great place to do it. And then when you're done, you upload it to blob storage or you email it to somebody and you're done. Who cares at that point? But if you're actually storing customer transactions, really, really bad place to do it is your local disk. I mean, like, really bad. Because if anything happens to it, those customer records are gone pretty much forever. So instead, if you use blobs, tables, or queues, or the drives mounted in a blob, we use what's called durable storage, meaning we keep 3 copies. And there are 3 copies spread out, not in the same rack necessarily. You know, it's all over the data center. And even if one of the copies gets destroyed, we're then building a new copy. So it's called durable storage. You're not going to lose the data. And now I'm waiting. 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi. Somebody's going to ask me about disaster recovery. I know it. Nobody?
What about disaster recovery?
Wow, what a pertinent question. What about disaster recovery? So something happened in the cloud like 2 months ago with Amazon's cloud in Northern Virginia. I think it was a big story around here, especially because it happened right near here. And everybody got really nervous about the cloud at that point, saying, oh, I can't believe this. You know, I could lose data in the cloud. Well, if you look at Netflix, they didn't lose any data. They never had any downtime. Why is that? Well, it's all about disaster recovery. And some people put all their eggs in one basket. If you just have everything in one data center, and we have 6 data centers worldwide, and this is a real thing to think about. You think about it with on-premise systems. What happens if Godzilla walks through Chicago? That's one of our big data centers, Chicago. If Godzilla actually shows up and steps on our data center, everything is gone. I mean, we did not build it to be Godzilla-proof, and really the foot will just go like right through and destroy everything. So for disaster recovery, it's a really good idea to think about putting some of your storage in another data center. We have another one down in, I think, Texas. So you can actually be copying your data, and yes, you're paying for double the storage. Prior to the event happening with Amazon, I would bring up disaster recovery to my ISVs and say, well, have you thought about this? Where are you going to put your backup? And their answer was, what do you mean backup? I'm in the cloud. You have durable storage. I don't need this anymore. I just deploy it to the cloud. And now I never have to ask the question. I get asked the question, what about DR? Can I put my data in 2 data centers just in case something happens? So I want you to think about that, because it should be part of your cost modeling when you think about moving to the cloud. And this goes beyond Windows Azure. This is any type of cloud deployment. You don't just get disaster recovery. You have to plan for it. You have to make sure you're copying your data to 2 different geographic regions. So we have 2 data centers in 3 geographic regions. We have 2 in the US, 2 in Europe, 2 in Asia. So wherever you're deploying your application, you want to think about making replicas of your data. And before you jump on the, oh, wow, that doubles my cost bandwagon, I want you to think about what typical disaster recovery solutions cost when that truck drives up to your data center and grabs all the mag tapes. You know, well, now they're cartridges. I guess I'm showing my age. But I mean, they grab the DAT tape cartridges. I mean, think about what that costs to move those to like Iron Mountain or wherever, one of these services that take your data away. It costs a lot more than paying for extra storage. And just in case anybody wanted to know, do I even have the pricing here? No, I don't. If you wanted to know what this storage costs, it's 15 cents per gigabyte per month. We're not talking like break the bank money here. So, I mean, you could do the math. was that, $150 per terabyte? Is that what it is? Something? I mean, it's not really expensive, and that's durable storage, and then just double that to store your stuff in another data center. I think we're still a fraction of what some of these offsite storage solutions cost. Yeah.
And so if you go from data center for your transfer, that's not a transfer cost as long as you're in the Microsoft cloud, or is it?
That's not true. The question was, is there transfer cost? So, and this comes, we're going to talk about an announcement that came today. So the question was about data transfer costs. Because yes, there's storage now. Let's say you put your stuff in Chicago, and now you put your stuff over here in the South Central, which is like in Texas. You're paying for that bandwidth to move the data. And it costs, I don't know, like 15 cents a gig to move that data. And then you pay on the other side. It's like 15 cents on one side for outbound and 10 cents a gig inbound. So there's a cost to move the data. There was an announcement today that starting with invoices on or after July 1st, inbound data, ingress data is free. There's no cost. That makes it really nice when you are importing a whole bunch of data or, as we just discussed, going between data centers. Any questions on that? I was hoping to actually show Visual Studio at some point. So,
how is it done? Is it automatically, the data transfer, or?
DR? Well, we have a service right now for SQL Azure, which is our SQL server. But for the other stuff, you'd have to do something. You know, like build it into your app. When you write it to blob storage, maybe write it to another. You know, maybe put it on two queues. You know, one for your local storage, one for your away storage.
That's not included in the app fabric with the geographic domains or whatever you guys call it?
So you're talking about what came out today with the app fabric applications?
No. I'm talking for Azure storage. Mm-hmm. I was under the impression that when you set up two geographic domains for your application, that application is automatically replicated.
Oh, are you talking about the traffic manager? There's a traffic manager service that's being tested right now, and that's for compute. So again, Godzilla comes into play and steps on Chicago. How nice would it be to have your service still running but in another data center, like your website? But that's not for storage, that's for your compute. Or if you want to load balance between regions. So the last piece I just want to go into, and then I actually want to show you what the tools look like so you can get up and running really quickly. I think that was kind of on the list of things I wanted to go over tonight, is the database, SQL Azure. SQL Azure will grow up to 50 gigabytes, and this is not really targeted right now for data warehousing, because warehouses go up into the multiple terabytes, and I've seen one petabyte database, but I mean 50 gigabytes, but then you could create what are called federated shards and build as many shards as you want, up to 50 gigabytes, so you could scale out as far as you want, and there's an entire API for that. Like if you wanted to store a customer record, you could figure out which of the 50 gig databases the customer should be in and then do a select or an insert onto that particular shard. The database will scale to, starts at 1 gigabyte and goes to 5, and then that's the web edition. You either toggle between 1 and 5, and then there's the business edition, which is 10 to 50. So pretty straightforward. It's $10 a gig per month, so it's more expensive than tables and blobs, but you also are getting the entire SQL Server engine at your disposal. You're running SQL queries and you have indexes, and this is a massively multi-tenant system that we've built, so we scale to demand. Any questions on that? I mean, you could run your stored procedures and triggers and all the stuff that you love with SQL. Anybody use SQL Server? So it's pretty painless moving to SQL Azure. I mean, there's a few system-level things you can't do. You can't organize your clusters and do all that kind of low-level stuff. We take care of that. We talked a little bit about access control. There's an entire access control service. So basically, it's like outsourcing your credentials. You may not want to use this. It's completely up to you. But if you want to allow things like a Google ID and a Live ID and Facebook and all these different ways of logging into your site, and we have ADFS, so you could use ACS. You could still do your own credentials management. Nothing stops you from doing it. And some systems, you have to have that completely locked down where you're managing everything. It's just an option. Yeah?
So Microsoft Identity Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
The way I heard people talk
Windows
about,
Identity Foundation, right.
How does that and this relate to each other?
So that's how you would use access control services.
The question.
I'm sorry. The question was, is this related to Windows Identity Foundation? And yes, that's how you would programmatically get to the access control services. And then we talked about the service bus, and the best way to think about service bus is like when you make a service call, a web service call. Imagine you hook one end, like the client side up, to the server side, and the way it connects is they both connect to a central point in the cloud. And now messages get relayed across that pipe, and that's how you get around issues like firewall issues. For instance, let's say that you are a restaurant chain and you have devices in every restaurant outlet, but the network is very locked down, but you still need to reach into all your, you need to make calls to all your restaurant terminals and say, what's your balance, or let me have your tickets. Service bus can help you with something like that. And then we have caching. We have a global caching solution. It's called the AppFabric Cache that went live, I guess, about a month ago. So I don't know if you are familiar with caching technologies. One thing's really important when you scale your website. Let's say that a user logs in to your website and they visit one of your instances, and let's say we scaled it out to 10 instances. They're going to visit instance one, and they're going to log in. And then they're going to go do something on instance two. We want to make sure that their session information can follow wherever they go. So you'd put that in that global cache, and that way when they hit server three and server four, the server is able to retrieve your information. Otherwise, if you use like a classic ASP.NET application and you had an in-process cache, which is in memory, the user would visit the first, he'd visit one time and log in, then he'd visit again thinking everything was great, and it would say, oh, you need to log in. Well, that's kind of odd. And that would happen like nine more times as they cycled through all your servers. So we have a caching service. And then what came out today, this was announced just a few hours ago, is we have what's called the AppFabric application. And this is brand new. I don't even have access to it yet. The idea is I just showed you a whole bunch of rectangles with curved corners. But I mean, they're rectangles. A whole bunch of things that you have to think about when you build an app. And AppFabric application lets you bundle it all into one cohesive unit. And I'll see if I can pull up the blog post that describes it and show you what that looks like. Any questions? Because I would like to show you what the tools look like. Because I'm sure that's why you came here, right? Not to listen to me ramble on slide decks all night?